Good morning. How are you? My name is Ralph McCullers. I'm the environmental director at the Porch Band of Creek Indians. It's in a state some of you may have heard of before, the great state of Alabama. So at any point during this process, if I lapse into Southern and you need translation, hold a hand up and I'll back up and do my best with that. That's where we are. We're in the southeast. We are about 8 miles northwest of the small town of Atmore, Alabama. The closest city, as it says there, is Mobile. We are kind of in what I call the magic triangle between Atmore, Mobile, and Pensacola, Florida. If any of you have any history at all with the U.S. Navy and their tendency to fly things, you know about Pensacola, Florida. We're located in Escambia County, which is predominantly agricultural, and it's, you know, Jennifer mentioned the economic challenges that many counties in the Dakotas face. We have very, very similar challenges as well in Alabama. It's not the place to go if you want to become wealthy. One of the biggest advantages that we have living in what's now called the state of Alabama is the quantity of water that moves through that state. It is one of the wettest states in the U.S. based on linear miles of moving water and surface acres of impounded water. What you're looking at in the upper left is a small blackwater creek that we have that's called Bell Creek, where we consistently do water monitoring there. That's one of my staff folks out doing some sampling there. The other three photographs, rounding out here to the right, are of the Big Escambia Creek. It's probably one of the most beautiful water bodies that you'll find in that area. Here's the problem with it. If you look at the map over here to the right with the state of Alabama, according to the EPA and the Alabama Department of Environmental Management, that beautiful water body that I showed you is impaired for beneficial uses. Part of what we're working toward with the sampling process is to remove that impairment from the water and prove to the state and to the federal government that it is indeed a clean section of stream. The pictures over here to the left are, these are my heartbreakers. It's really kind of hard to make out, but the top picture is actually two deer carcasses. And that was made off of a bridge. The area that this was made in, where those carcasses were deposited, was the traditional baptismal hole, just a wide spot in the creek, where when the Episcopal missionaries came into Porch in the early 1920s, where many, many, many of our living tribal elders were baptized into the Episcopal Church in that spot. And then you take two things that are most sacred historically to the Creek Indian, the white-tailed deer and water, and look what the combination gets you. I just have a real hard time with this. So we struggle as far as education and knowledge, even internally with Indian people and what we need to be doing. The pictures down below are of some different water bodies that we have that I affectionately refer to as the beaver ponds. These pictures were made about 3 years ago when we had a significant fish kill. We had had a very dry summer. It was hotter than blue blazes, and we had most of you are familiar with the idea of dissolved oxygen. Well, we had a very low dissolved oxygen for about a 10-day period, and it killed damn near everything that lived in the pond. It was bad. The sludge, the things from the bacteria washing up, the fish corpses, the eel corpses, it was quite a mess. Let's talk about something a little better. One of the nice things, you know, both Kristen and Jennifer have talked about sovereignty and reservation land. What we have on some of our land is our drinking water system. There is not a tribal member who lives in the vicinity who does not have safe drinking water. And I say that with a tremendous amount of pride, not for my accomplishments, but for our utilities department and the guys that do that. They really get a lot of stuff done to make sure that we don't have to worry about the issues that many other Native nations do because of the lack of a good, safe drinking water supply. One of the things that we undertake, the staff that I support, is on Arbor Week, we give away trees. and not just three or four trees. This last time we gave away, 2,000 in 2013, and I'm staging a one-man boycott of all things pine. If you go to the state of Alabama, in the I am. In the state of Alabama, the largest legal cash crop is the pine tree. You'll notice I said legal. And what has happened is there have been hundreds of thousands of acres of beautiful bottom wood, beautiful woods coming out of these creek bottoms, these rolling hills coming down the Piedmont Plateau that have just been decimated and put back with nothing but pine trees, okay? So me being me and somewhat stubborn, I said, we ain't giving out pine trees. We're going to go back to the old traditional trees. So we gave away chinkapin, which is a variety of oak that white-tailed deer love, French tree, which some of you may know as Grancy Graybeard. Again, it's a very southern, very native species. Ma'am? I'm sorry, I'll work on that. And of course, the pawpaw and the magnolia. Again,
I just love that you think we know it. Whatever.
I'll send you some. But the that's it. That's the Grancy Graybeard right there, the blooming French tree. Or some people call it a smoke tree. Generally, they only smoke when you set them on fire. But that was from a misguided youth. But what we're trying to do is reestablish among our tribal people and our tribal government employees that we're missing out on stuff. So we bring these things back and actually put the trees in their hands with instructions. I'll send my staff folks out to the seniors and help our elders plant the very trees that they saw as they were children and bring them back into the immediate area. This is another one that I'm just dearly in love with. I told my folks early on, I said, you come to me with a project, if you can defend it and it's valid and we can get funding, I'll give you a chance at it. So this is exactly what happened here. One of my guys comes to me one day and says, I want to keep bees. I said, all right, tell me why. He goes through the whole thing about the global honeybee population crash and the whole nine yards. And I said, all right, where's your funding? He handed me three completed grant applications. All right, let's start squeezing bees. So we did. At this point, we have five viable active hives, which may not sound like a lot, but we just got the first hive put into a hive box back in February of this year. To date, we have gotten about 25 gallons of honey out of those bees. And here's the thing about honey. I know that as we go through this, you're all public health people, all right? And every one of you sitting here foaming at the mouth going, there is no data. They have not given us a spreadsheet, okay? So the problem that I ran into with my honey was this. When word got out that we had this raw honey, that the only thing we had done was filter out the wax and put in jars, it disappeared. It was like there were honey ninjas all over my reservation. We had the boxes and stuff set up like this. I put a jar of that honey on my desk in my office because I have a hot tea habit, and I like honey in it. We went to lunch. When I came back, every jar of that honey was gone, every bit of it. And that happened with the first three batches we made. So the good news is we're getting honey. The other good news is that it's local honey, and it's raw, it's unpasteurized, and you all know the health benefits and the potential good that can come from that. The other good news is that we apparently have a tremendous distribution network that I know nothing about. but that's one of the hands-on things that we're doing, and we're doing it right there.
Self-determined individuals.
In our place. And the bees, the honey, the pollen that's being interacted with are coming from what is gradually becoming a more traditional plant base. So I think this is good progress. This is our community garden. This has been the first growing season. Our tribal council agreed to fund this and let us get moving on it back, a year ago last month in October. We hired some staff. We started buying equipment. We started buying seed. We started combining seed with soil, and things started to happen. So far, well, let me back up. With Porch, we have just over 3,100 enrolled tribal members, the vast majority of whom live within five counties in the south western part of Alabama and a very northwestern county in Florida. There are approximately 2,000 families in that immediate area. In just 1 year of this little garden that we've had growing, we have gotten produce from that garden to over 1,000 different families. All right, a 30% contact rate for you statisticians and data folks, about a 30% contact rate within the first year. I am extremely proud of my guys and my ladies and the work that they have done with this. It's kind of grassy there, but there somewhere out there are butter beans and peas. We've got collards and greens, turnips, for those of you that may not be familiar with the collard. These are just some more pictures of it. In the upper left, this is one that I was really excited about. We had one of the old grandmothers come in one day after the word had gotten out at two or three council meetings and whatnot, and we had the first few distributions of food, which coincidentally we took to our senior center and made sure that our elders were fed first and fed best. So a few weeks later, one of the grandmothers comes in with this little shopping bag, and in the shopping bag are those jars, and each of them were labeled. These are very old gourd seeds. The gourd to the Creek Indian was a useful thing. It was used for dipping. It was used for storage. It was used for decoration, for the crafts. So having these heritage seeds, having these heirloom seeds, is a very big deal for us. And we've got a particular plot down at one end of the garden that is going to be our heritage garden. So we'll be growing those gourds there. Same thing in the lower right. Our tribal historic preservation officer came in one day and asked me if I wanted some corn. You know, knowing Robert like I know Robert, I thought he was talking about corn liquor. So I said, Robert, we're at work. We can't do that. He's like, no, it's real corn like seeds. He had discovered on some of his travels what appears to be some of the near the original corn that we grew in the area. So I'm real proud to have that. And then these are turnip seeds. And Daryl, my garden supervisor, is planting those. And what I want you to notice with that turnip seed is the size of it. Okay, and we've taken something that was just the germ of an idea that probably at some point wasn't any bigger than yonder turnip seed, and we've touched 1,000 families with it. I can't tell you how many pounds, I would assume logically and I think safely, how many tons of clean, local, free to the recipient food we've generated from that. The other thing about that, getting back to the comments that Isaiah made that I thought were just absolutely sage wisdom about the separation of culture causing a decrease in health. Even though our young people don't realize what we're doing, the fact that we're doing this garden and the food is being distributed at no cost to our tribal members and tribal government employees is exactly how, prior to 1830, prior to the Indian Removal Act, that Creek villages were structured. Each family had their own little garden plot where they would have, you know, specific things for them. But in the center of the village, there was a ceremonial ground, there was a stickball ground, which was the predecessor to modern lacrosse. There was also a community or a village garden. That's where the bigger, more labor-intensive produce plants and things were grown. So we're getting back to that. Now, granted, it's a little different. We got tractors. We have to use some chemicals in it, but we're getting back to that culture. And I am very hopeful that by doing that, that we can reduce the diabesity that we're seeing that's endemic in our tribe and most others throughout the country. The other part of my plan for world domination is this. When all is said and done, the United States around us can have a tremendous meltdown, a tremendous issue. My goal is that on that reservation, I will not have fat Indians, but I will have fed Indians. Okay? So step one, obviously, we got to get some fiber, some roughage, some good vegetables. We got it. We've got the honey. What's the last thing that's missing? A good, clean protein component to the diet. So, that being said, let's get some fish. All right? We have several ponds. This is my beaver pond here, and I have a special relationship with that beaver. And I'll explain that to y'all later, but me and that beaver. Have you seen the movie Caddyshack? Okay, you remember Carl and the gopher? All right, well, that's me and that aggravating beaver. Anyway, the beavers will be the death of me. In this pond, this is a very naturally formed pond. We did dam it up just a little bit to get some more depth to it, but there's an amazing variety of fish species in there. There's a very few catfish. There are a lot of brim. We have both small and largemouth bass. The other day I was walking through there and I spotted a spotted gar, which for freshwater fisheries in the South, the alligator gar is a very sensitive critter. He's not much to look at, but he's a good indicator of the health of your system. So seeing a spotted gar about 20, 24 inches long in that pond was a great thing to get a hold of. We also have a lot of our tribal members will fish this pond. So I know that we've got good production and good turnover in it. We have an additional half a dozen dug created ponds that have been filled with catfish and hybrid brim. They have not in the past several years been maintained properly. So as I move forward with getting my folks on board and increasing capacity, we're going to begin revitalizing those ponds so that we can have, again, for our tribal members, a source of good, clean protein. That's some pictures of the catfish ponds I was talking about there. The one over here on the left, if any of y'all know a hydrogeologist, please connect me with them. That one's got a leak that I can't find. And that's me. That's how you get a hold of me. So, questions, comments, categorical denials? Yes, ma'am.
How big is that garden?
That garden is, in three separate plots, we have just shy of 7 acres of surface.
And about how much does it cost you actually run that farm?
That's going to be tough to say, and here's why. This is our first growing season, and we started with nothing. I bought a tractor. I bought implements for the tractor, the whole nine yards. To get it up and going, I would safely say we spent $75,000, but that was getting two wells drilled for irrigation, purchasing tractor, implements, seed. We did a lot of infrastructure work with the gardens as well. Yes, ma'am.
You had a slide early in the presentation where you have seen and unseen hazards. Thank you. The water supply at the same time. What were some of the unseen hazards? I think you talked about the seen ones, but I'm not sure.
The unseen hazards that we have, and I was referring primarily to the EPA's 303D listing under the Clean Water Act, are things like mercury in the water, mercury in the fish. We're in a very heavily agricultural area, so contaminated runoff is a big issue. One thing I didn't touch on, and this will mean a lot to you public health folks, is we also have a very, very high quality wastewater treatment plant on the reservation. The good news about that is that we can eliminate failing septic systems and get those out. The bad news is going north from Big Escambia Creek, which is right along here, there's a very high level of poverty, very high level of agriculture, so we can't go past the reservation and begin replacing these failing systems as it comes downstream. Yes.
I'm really
We are doing ours. Her question was, she expressed an interest in the community garden and wanted to know how I staffed it. Was it strictly volunteer, or their paid positions? What's happening with that? We have a combination. We're not doing a true community garden where folks, where a family or a neighborhood would have a block. Essentially, what we're doing is a truck patch where we grow it and distribute it. That being said, most of the work done there is done by staff that I support in the environmental department. We do have organizations both at our gaming operation and others that have called and said, I want to bring my managers over and we want to give you a day. And I sign them up and get them in. So it's some of both. Yes, ma'am. The question is about how we stock the ponds, and we use both methods. For the contained constructed ponds, we will stock those. For the beaver pond that I was showing, that is a natural stocking.
And also, what is the access to the pond? Like, how does it work?
At this point, the primary access is restricted to tribal members or tribal government employees. Because all of those ponds are on reservation land, so it's not necessarily a public public resource at this point. That's correct. Yes. No.
The fish in the tribal waters. Have you tested it from our 3 PCBs and our nanophosphates?
You need to get out of my head. The question was, have we tested the fish? This spring, the index period for aquatic organisms in the state of Alabama runs from mid-May to mid-June. This spring, we're going to have a team from EPA's SESD, Science and Ecology Support Division, from Atlanta come down and spend about a week with us. We're going to do water column sampling, sediment sampling, fish tissue analyses, and we're going to couple that with the water quality monitoring that we've been doing for years.